Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the November 5th, 2021, Friday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Tammy. Today, I'll be reading the following main articles. Janelle Matthews' murder case, mistrial declared after jury fails to reach verdict, by the Associated Press. Polis defends tax history, by Alex Burness and Saja Hindi of the Denver Post. And by January 4th, vaccines or tests will be mandatory, by David Koenig of the Associated Press. And I'll be following up with miscellaneous articles. Our first story, Janelle Matthews' murder case, mistrial declared after jury fails to reach verdict. Prosecutors to discuss Monday whether to try defendant a second time, by the Associated Press. Dateline, Greeley. The trial of a former long-shot Idaho gubernatorial candidate charged in the killing and death of 12-year-old Janelle Matthews in 1984 ended Thursday with jurors unable to reach verdicts on the most serious charges against him. After 3 weeks of testimony, jurors found Steve Pankey, 70, guilty of false reporting, but could not reach agreement on murder and kidnapping charges. Weld County District Attorney Michael Rourke pressed for District Judge Timothy Kearns to offer an instruction encouraging jurors to reach a verdict, but Kearns said further deliberation would not change anyone's vote. Gloria Matthews, Janelle's mother, was in tears in the courtroom as the judge declared a mistrial. They were hoping for some closure, like we talked about during the course of this trial, Rourke said of the girl's family during a news conference. I know that they wanted to make a statement to the jury even before the trial was over, about thanking them for participating in the process, being a part of this very long trial. Pankey, described by his lawyer as a paranoid true crime junkie, testified in his own defense, delivering sometimes rambling testimony. He said he pretended to know information about the case out of bitterness for police and because he wanted his former church and former employer investigated. He denied being involved in Janelle's disappearance and death. Pankey was a neighbor of Janelle and her family when she vanished after she was dropped off at her empty home by a family friend after performing at a Christmas concert in Greeley. He emerged as a person of interest in the case 3 decades later, shortly before Janelle's body was found in 2019, after claiming to have information about what happened to her and asking for immunity from prosecution. A hearing is scheduled Monday to sentence Pankey for the false reporting conviction and to discuss whether prosecutors will try to put him on trial for a second time for murdering and kidnapping. The false reporting charge was added after Pankey testified as a witness and admitted to lying to law enforcement in the past about the case. At the news conference, Rourke said he didn't regret taking the case to trial and that he was prepared to go through it again. Lacking physical evidence, the prosecution relied heavily on testimony from Pankey's ex-wife, who said Pankey unexpectedly announced the night that Janelle disappeared that they were leaving to visit family in California early the next day. It also pointed to Pankey's unwarranted visits and statements to law enforcement about the case, including sharing information it said had not been made public. Pankey's lawyer, Anthony Viorst, told jurors that Pankey, diagnosed with Asperger syndrome, was a jerk to his ex-wife and others, but was not a murderer. He also tried to generate reasonable doubt about his client's involvement by raising the possibility of an alternate suspect. During his testimony, Pankey spoke about being bullied for being bisexual and his hatred of racist police officers from his time working on an ambulance in California. In one example, he spoke about withholding treatment from an injured sheriff's deputy who was crying in pain because of his view of police. Prosecutors said Pankey kept up to date on the case throughout the years, even as he moved his family to several states before settling in Idaho, where he ran unsuccessfully as a Constitution Party candidate for Idaho governor in 2014 and in the Republican gubernatorial primary in 2018, the year that authorities said he was named as a person of interest in the girl's death. Fiorst told reporters afterward that he wasn't surprised by the outcome, but perhaps a bit frustrated. "I think we're all a bit frustrated," Fiorst said, "but it was a very hotly contested trial, and there was certainly quite a bit of evidence of Mr. Pankey's innocence, so I could see why they wouldn't be able to reach a verdict." Janelle's family searched fruitlessly for years, and her picture was printed on milk cartons during a national missing children's campaign in the 1980s. She was considered missing until workers digging a pipeline in a rural area near Greeley in July 2019 discovered human remains matching her dental records. Her death was then ruled a homicide. She died from a single gunshot wound to the head, prosecutors said, and the Greeley Tribune contributed to this report. ProPublica investigation: Polis defends tax history. Fellow Democrats say findings highlight massive inequity, by Alex Burness and Sasha Hindi. 4 months ago, when Governor Jared Polis signed a package of bills to reduce tax breaks for wealthy people and corporations and shift savings to low- and middle-income people and small businesses, he lamented that fiscal policy in this state, as with the country, rewards moneyed interests at the expense of the rest. All too often, it's the big guys that have the lobbyists and get the special interest breaks. And as a result, everybody else pays more than they should in taxes, the Democrats said at the time. But Polis, whose net worth has been valued in the hundreds of millions, benefited from the very imbalance he described that day, according to a new report by ProPublica that details how ultra-rich political figures, such as Polis, have been able to avoid paying taxes in some cases or pay low rates in others. If you paid any federal income tax in 2013, 2014, or 2015, you paid more than Polis did, the outlet reported. It added that for most of the past decade, the governor's overall tax rate was less than half of what would have been paid by a worker making $45,000 in 2018. ProPublica's report published Thursday morning showed that the difference is consistent with a system that has helped many other ultra-rich people, including politicians and corporate executives, avoid paying much of their overall wealth in taxes. That's because of legal structures that allow wealthy people to categorize their money outside of income taxes. The Denver Post reported 3 years ago that Polis owed no federal income tax for 5 years in the early 2000s, even as he, then in his 20s, was already worth millions. Polis was worth more than $300 million as of 2017, the nonprofit Open Secrets reports. That made the former U.S. representative from Boulder among the five richest members of Congress. He did not release recent tax returns during his 2018 run for governor because he said he wouldn't do it as long as then-opponent Walker Stapleton also refused. In an interview with Colorado Public Radio on Thursday, Polis did not commit to releasing his returns during his 2022 re-election bid, but suggested he would do it if his opponent, undecided at the time, would. Polis's office defended him to ProPublica and again in a written statement to the Denver Post on Thursday. Governor Polis has paid all the taxes that he is required by law, and no one has suggested otherwise, and he completely agrees that the tax system disproportionately favors the wealthy, spokesperson Elizabeth Kosar said. That's why he has long championed tax reforms to make a better, fairer system, especially for middle-class workers and families. Kosar also noted the package of tax-related bills Polis signed this summer to close unfair loopholes and tax giveaways that benefit the wealthy and well-connected to increase support for working families and small businesses. But fellow Colorado Democratic officials who have worked with, and in some cases against, Polis on fiscal policy said the report on the taxes paid by Polis and other rich politicians spotlights the fundamental economic inequity in this country. State Representative David Ortiz, a Democrat from Littleton, said people such as Polis should not be punished for success. Ortiz added, however, "I can't think of anything more un-American, unpatriotic, than someone perpetuating a system where those that benefit the most, those that are the wealthiest, don't pay their fair share." Representative Emily Sirota, a Democrat from Littleton, who was a lead sponsor on bills Polis touted at the June signing event, said in a text message, "The wealthiest individuals and corporations should pay their fair share, and what we know for certain is that under our current tax system, they often do not. Middle and lower income people who are struggling to recover from the pandemic pay a higher effective tax rate than those who are thriving." Sirota said she hopes Congress raises taxes on the wealthy, something it is considering as a way to help pay for a $1.75 trillion domestic spending package. That is key to President Joe Biden's agenda. Polis told Colorado Public Radio that he supports the spending plan. Senator Chris Hansen of Denver, Sirota's co-lead on the tax reform bills, said ProPublica's report wasn't very surprising because we have a tax system in this country that is highly beneficial to the super wealthy and is not fair for working families. But he said it highlights the need to continue reforming the system in future legislative sessions. For Progressive Bell Policy Center Executive Director Scott Wasserman, ProPublica's findings reflect his group's experience that it has been so hard to get this governor to, one, acknowledge how unfair our tax code is, and two, to really think about the unique obstacles in Colorado to taxing wealth. "I've got no problem with wealth, but we work with wealthy individuals who use their wealth and privilege to advocate for a fairer tax code," Wasserman added. "And I guess my surprise has always been, why is he unwilling to acknowledge how this issue plays for him individually and what his obligation is to all the folks who are not punching at such a high tax rate?" Often on the other side of the tax debates with the Bell Policy Center is the conservative group Colorado Rising State Action, which advocates for lower taxes, such as the unsuccessful measure on this week's ballot to cut property taxes. Executive Director Michael Fields said it's clear why the governor did not release his tax returns in the past. "Wealthy people shouldn't be getting an advantage, whether that is individuals or businesses. I think that there should be a fair system where small businesses are valued the same as big businesses are. And on the individual side, that individuals and families have the same system that wealthy people do," Fields said. In an emailed statement, state GOP chairwoman Christy Burton Brown called details in ProPublica's story shameful and criticized Democrats in the state for fighting every day to raise taxes on Coloradans, something Polis has advocated only in narrow cases such as nicotine, marijuana, and pollution taxation. The GOP frontrunner to oppose Polis in the 2022 election, University of Colorado Regent Heidi Ganahl, herself a millionaire, commented on the ProPublica report through a spokesperson. If this is true, Jared Polis has a lot of explaining to do. There has been a lack of transparency and honesty in his administration. It would appear this is yet another example of that. Asked if she would release her taxes if she were to be nominated to run for governor, Ganahl said, "I'm not opposed to releasing my taxes if Jared Polis releases his taxes." Many others, including leaders of all four state house caucuses, either declined to comment or could not be reached Thursday. Polis has founded or co-founded about 20 companies, starting with an early internet system provider, American Information Systems, that he formed with a couple of friends in their dorms at Princeton University. The company sold for $23 million in 1998. The next year, he led the sale of his family's e-card business, Blue Mountain Arts, for $780 million. It was one of the biggest cash-outs of the dot-com era. Just 2 years after the Polis sale, Blue Mountain sold again for only $35 million. In 2000, Polis began working on a new company, a floral arrangement delivery service that would later be named Pro Flowers. In 2006, the company sold for $477 million. Not all of the money from those and other ventures went to him directly, but as ProPublica's report notes, Polis was worth an estimated $143 million by 2010. The governor often has used his money to advance his political career by pouring record amounts into his own campaigns. He also has used his money to benefit other Democrats, and he was a member of the Gang of Four, along with Pat Stryker, Tim Gill, and Rhett Bridges, that spent big in the mid-2000s to support liberal causes and help Democrats gain a trifecta at the state capitol. Polis spent an unheard of $1.2 million of his own money to get himself narrowly elected to the State Board of Education when he was 25 years old. He spent $1.56 for every vote he won in that race, to his opponents, one penny per vote. Polis broke state records when he spent more than $23 million on his own gubernatorial election. The campaign was almost entirely self-funded, as that year he limited campaign donations from individuals to $100. Democratic insiders say he's prepared to spend extravagantly again for re-election in 2022. ProPublica's report shows that other ways Polis has used his money to promote his brand. The report states that the Jared Polis Foundation spent more than $2 million from 2001 to 2008 on mailers with his name and image. These mailers, close in appearance to campaign mailers, were filed as charitable expenditures, ProPublica reported. As governor, Polis consistently has leaned conservative on fiscal policy. In this area, he was distanced from legislative Democrats the day he took office, as he pushed for a cut to Colorado's flat income tax. That flat rate, the state's research has shown, leaves the poor paying higher taxes as a percentage of their overall income. State House Democrats had no interest in lowering the income tax rate, and Polis's insistence on this policy stalled negotiations on a 2020 bill meant to eliminate certain tax breaks for the wealthy. Democrats eventually scaled back that bill dramatically to please the governor. Polis got his way a few months later when voters passed a cut to the state income tax rate, which Polis never formally endorsed but has celebrated openly since the 2020 election. More recently, Polis advocated for eliminating the state income tax, appearing at a conservative conference in Beaver Creek in August with his friend Art Laffer, the economist and former advisor to President Ronald Reagan. Polis said the state income tax should be zero. we can find another way to generate revenue that doesn't discourage productivity and growth. And you absolutely can, and we should, he said. But Polis doesn't have the power to do that on his own, and leaders within the Democrat-led legislature told the Denver Post they would never support such a plan. Most of Polis' fellow Democrats at the Capitol, in fact, want to see an opposite policy in which the wealthy pay higher state income taxes. Several progressive groups floated a ballot measure last year to raise taxes on income above $250,000 and lower taxes on income below that amount. The Post at the time asked Polis to comment on the proposal, which never made the ballot, and the governor declined. In this week's election, Polis endorsed a property tax cut widely opposed by Democrats and even some legislative Republicans. That measure failed overwhelmingly, as did a tax on marijuana products to pay for educational programming, which Polis also endorsed. Large companies, by January 4th, vaccines or tests will be mandatory, by David Koenig. Tens of millions of Americans who work at companies with 100 or more employees will need to be vaccinated fully against COVID-19 by January 4th, or get tested for the virus weekly under government rules issued Thursday. The new requirements are the Biden administration's boldest move yet to persuade reluctant Americans to get a vaccine that has been widely available for months or face financial consequences. If successful, administration officials believe it will go a long way toward ending a pandemic that has killed more than 750,000 Americans. First previewed by President Joe Biden in September, the requirements will apply to about 84 million workers at medium and large businesses, although it is not clear how many of those employees are vaccinated or unvaccinated. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration regulations will force the companies to require that unvaccinated workers test negative for COVID-19 at least once a week and wear a mask while in the workplace. OSHA left open the possibility of expanding the requirement to smaller businesses. It asked for public comment on whether employers with fewer than 100 employees could handle vaccination or testing programs. Tougher rules will apply to an additional 17 million people working in nursing homes, hospitals, and other facilities that receive money from Medicare and Medicaid. Those workers will not have an option for testing. They will need to be vaccinated. Workers will be able to ask for exemptions on medical or religious grounds. The requirements will not apply to people who work at home or outdoors. Biden framed the issue as a simple choice between getting more people vaccinated or prolonging the pandemic. While I would have much preferred that requirements not become necessary, too many people remain unvaccinated for us to get out of this pandemic for good, he said Thursday in a statement. Biden said his encouragement for businesses to impose mandates and his own previous requirements for the military and federal contractors have helped reduce the number of unvaccinated Americans over 12 from 100 million in late July to about 60 million now. Those measures, he said, have not led to mass firings or worker shortages, adding that the vaccines have been required before to fight other diseases. OSHA said companies that fail to comply with the regulations could face penalties of nearly $14,000 per violation. The agency will face enforcement challenges. Even counting help from states, OSHA has only 1,850 inspectors to oversee 130 million workers at 8 million workplaces. And administration officials said the agency will respond to whistleblower complaints and make limited spot checks. The release of the rules followed weeks of regulatory review and meetings with business groups, labor unions, and others. OSHA drafted the rules under emergency authority meant to protect workers from an imminent health hazard. The agency estimated that the vaccine mandate will save more than 6,500 worker lives and prevent more than 250,000 hospitalizations over the next 6 months. The rules set up potential legal battles along partisan lines between states and the federal government. Several states and Republican governors threatened to sue, contending that the administration lacks the power to make such sweeping mandates under emergency authority. OSHA's parent agency, the Labor Department, said it is on sound legal footing. The department's top legal official, Seema Nanda, said OSHA rules preempt conflicting state laws or orders, including those that bar employers from requiring vaccinations, testing, or face masks. The rules will require workers to receive two doses of the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines, or one dose of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine by January 4th, or be tested weekly. Employees testing positive must be removed from the workplace. Companies will not be required to provide or pay for tests for unvaccinated workers, but they must give paid time off for employees to get the shots and sick leave to recover from side effects that prevent them from working. Requirements for masks and paid time off for shots take effect December 5th. Employers covered by the requirements must verify their workers' vaccination status by checking documents such as CDC vaccination cards or records from doctors or pharmacies. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services issued a separate rule requiring vaccination for workers in 76,000 health facilities and home health care providers that get funding from the government health programs. A senior administration official said several large private healthcare organizations imposed their own mandates and achieved high vaccination rates, 96% or higher, without widespread resignations. A previously announced requirement for federal contractors to make sure workers are vaccinated was scheduled to take effect December 8th, but the administration delayed that measure until January 4th to match the requirements on other large employers and healthcare providers. Already, more than a dozen states have sued to block the mandate on contractors. For weeks, Biden has encouraged businesses not to wait for OSHA to act. Moving to page two. Remains thought to be hiker missing since 1983, Dateline Rocky Mountain National Park. Skeletal remains found in the park are believed to be those of a 27-year-old man from West Germany who disappeared during a multi-day mountaineering trip nearly 40 years ago, park officials said Thursday. Rudy Motor, an experienced winter mountaineer who was living in Fort Collins, left the Zimmerman Lake trailhead on Colorado 17 near Cameron Pass for a 2 to 3 night ski mountaineering trip over Thunder Pass and into the park on February 13, 1983. His roommate reported him overdue February 19, 1983. Searchers started looking for Motor the following day, but more than a foot of fresh snow prevented them from finding tracks or other clues immediately. The only major clues found during the four-day search were a food cache belonging to Motor that was discovered at the mouth of a canyon in the northwest corner of the park, and a nearby snow cave with Motor's sleeping bag and other gear and items inside. The search included teams on skis and snowshoes, a dog trained to find people in avalanche debris, and a helicopter. Additional searches were conducted that spring and into the summer. In August 2020, a hiker found human remains near avalanche debris in the Skeleton Gulch area. Rangers conducted an initial investigation at the scene, but could not complete the investigation because of closures and shifting priorities caused by the Cameron Peak fire and then the East Troublesome fire. Snow then blanketed the area above 11,000 feet. This summer, park rangers returned to the area and found skis, poles, boots, and other personal items believed to have belonged to Motor. The Grand County Coroner's Office tried to confirm the identity of the remains through dental records, but the results were inconclusive. Officials have worked extensively with the German government for repatriation, family notification, and dental record analysis. Still, park officials say they consider the case closed and are working with the German government to repatriate the remains. The discovery and recovery of Rudy Motor's remains closes out a nearly four-decade-long cold case at Rocky Mountain National Park, park officials said. Colorado Court of Appeals, 1994 Law Unconstitutional by Shelley Bradbury. The Colorado Court of Appeals struck down a state law as unconstitutional Thursday, finding that felony criminal defendants are entitled to a 12-person jury, and that the law saying otherwise was wrong. The unanimous decision stemmed from the 2016 Denver case, in which 11 of 12 jurors wanted to find a man guilty of cocaine possession, but the last juror refused to vote guilty because he philosophically disagreed with the state's drug laws, according to court documents. The judge presiding over the trial dismissed the one holdout juror, finding he was refusing to follow the law and perform his duties as a juror, and sent the remaining 11 jurors back to continue deliberating. The jury then returned a guilty verdict. The judge followed state law, which explicitly allows an 11-person jury to return a verdict if a juror is dismissed for cause after deliberations begin. But the Court of Appeals on Thursday overturned the man's conviction and ordered that he be given a new trial because that law violates the state's constitution. The statute is invalid, a panel of three judges wrote in the opinion. It's rare for the courts to invalidate state laws as unconstitutional, Denver attorney Christopher Jackson said. The Court of Appeals decision may apply retroactively, but it's unlikely to affect many defendants because jurors are not often dismissed for cause after a jury begins deliberating and after alternate jurors have been dismissed. This would be a very small group of people because this just doesn't happen very often, he said. The state law allowing an 11-person jury verdict was passed in 1994, with the idea that carving out the exception would save courts the expense of redoing trials after getting all the way to the late stage of jury deliberation, according to the Court of Appeals opinion. At the time, lawmakers believed Colorado's constitution did not guarantee the right to a 12-person jury. But the groundwork for Thursday's decision was laid in 2005, when the Colorado Supreme Court found that the state constitution did, in fact, guarantee defendants the right to a 12-person jury in felony criminal trials. At the time, now retired Judge Justice Nathan Ben Coates noted that the justice's decision all but strikes down the General Assembly's attempt to avoid mistrials upon the dismissal of a juror for cause during deliberations, the opinion says. The panel of judges agreed with Coates' 2005 assessment in their opinion on Thursday. The right with which we are concerned is the right to be tried by a 12-person jury, the opinion reads. Such right is not vindicated simply because 12 jurors are selected to serve. Such right is effectuated only when 12 jurors complete the trial and deliberate to a conclusion in the case. Northwestern Colorado, Moffitt County voters reject EMS funding by Alex Burness. The second largest county in Colorado has no sustainable funding plan for emergency medical services after Tuesday's sound defeat of a pair of ballot measures that would have funded ambulance crews into the future. Even now, when people in Moffat County, in the state's northwest corner, especially those who live in the most remote areas, call for an ambulance, there may be no one available to take the call, or the response time may be dangerously low. Slow, officials said. That's a trend across other rural parts of Colorado and the country, and it could get even more dire. The reality is this is a service that's taken for granted, and I don't know how to make that a reality for people without it becoming a reality where people suffer life-changing consequences, said Jennifer Riley, interim CEO of Memorial Regional Health in Craig, Moffitt's population center. Ballot returns as of noon Wednesday showed voters in Moffat, almost the size of Connecticut and home to about 13,000 people, swung 2-1 against a ballot proposal to tax the average homeowner about $35 more a year to fund EMS services. About 58% of voters rejected a related proposal to restructure emergency services in such a way that it would have been funded as its own district, similar to the setup of many fire departments. That means the county continues operating on a thin, patchwork EMS service. A crew operates out of the hospital in Craig, but members of that crew say they are frequently overwhelmed and sometimes unable to get to callers quickly. About 30 miles west, the community of Maybell has a volunteer-only crew that is not always available. Even farther west, around Dinosaur, residents have to rely on ambulances from Utah that take some time to arrive if they're available at all. We've failed Dinosaur, Melissa Dubrava, an organizer for the unsuccessful campaign to create new EMS funding, told the Denver Post late Tuesday. When someone is in an emergency, they rely on an ambulance from Utah. They live every day knowing emergency medical attention is a 45-minute call away, and that's if Utah has the capacity to respond. This should not be the reality for our neighbors. We can do this better. The current bare-bones system is not sustainable, officials at Memorial Regional Health in Craig said. The hospital takes a loss of about $600,000 annually on EMS, and its leaders say that cannot continue. For now, they say they will continue taking that loss and try again at the ballot next year. They don't want to entertain the thought of shutting down the county's main EMS crew yet. I'm reluctant to put a drop-dead date, but maybe there's a time when we need to do that, Hospital Board Chief Kelly Hepworth said. Healthcare leaders in the county know a ballot package next year concerning emergency services would face an uphill battle in this conservative, tax-averse county, as this year's version did. But if people are not willing to pay for it now, they risk paying for it in other ways down the road, Riley said. Moving inside the paper is a photo of a little girl getting a shot. With the headline, Kaiser Rolls Out Vaccines for Kids, Lila Uran, 11, of Broomfield, receives a COVID-19 vaccine shot from nurse Joe Pumo at the Kaiser Permanente Lone Tree Medical Offices on Thursday. Lila was one of the first 5 to 11-year-olds to get the shot at a Kaiser Permanente facility in the state. The federal government approved the vaccines for that age group this week, and that was by Eric Lutzen of the Denver Post. Man charged in flight attendant confrontation by Colleen Slevin of the Associated Press. A 20-year-old California man accused of assaulting a flight attendant on a cross-country American Airlines flight allegedly punched the woman in the face after being told he could not use the bathroom, leaving her bleeding around her nose and giving her a concussion, according to a court document. Prosecutors announced Monday that Brian Hsu, 20, of Irvine, was charged with assault and interfering with a flight crew on a flight last week from John F. Kennedy International Airport in New York to John Wayne Airport in Santa Ana, California. He appeared in federal court in California on Monday and was released on $10,000 bail. He was ordered to appear in federal court in Denver, where the flight was diverted after the alleged assault on November 15th. According to an affidavit from an FBI agent who investigated, four witnesses and the flight attendant, who was not named, said Hsu punched the attendant on the October 27th flight. Meanwhile, Hsu, who said he was returning home after undergoing brain surgery in Rhode Island, told investigators that the attendant charged at him, hitting her nose on his palm. Hsu said while stretching, he accidentally hit the flight attendant with his arm or hand, and she began swinging at him with her hands. Fearing she was going to hit him in the head, he raised his hands defensively, he said. According to Hsu, the attendant then charged at him, hitting his palm. The attendant told investigators that she was talking to a co-worker when she felt something hit her head and turned around to see Hsu, who said he wanted to use the bathroom, the document said. She said she told him no because the fasten seatbelt sign was on. Housing. Campaign to aid families with funds by Kieran Nicholson. A campaign to raise $75,000 to help people gain or keep housing in the Denver area during the holiday season runs this month through the end of the year. The Within Reach Giving Campaign, part of the Metro Denver Homeless Initiative, starts Tuesday and runs through December 31st, according to a news release. The campaign has a goal of helping 50 families with housing. MDHI works with more than 80 local organizations to provide one-time emergency funds to households facing a housing crisis, the release said. When all other funding has been exhausted, the Housing Stability Fund steps in. Without the Housing Stability Fund, hundreds in our region would have fallen into homelessness or remained unhoused over the past 3 years, said Jamie Reif, MDHI's Director of Communications, in the release. This is literally a fund of last resort when all other avenues have been exhausted by a household's case manager. The Housing Stability Fund is supported by the Metro Mayor's Caucus, the Denver Foundation, Mile High United Way, Wells Fargo, and private donors. Funding is issued to a third-party vendor, such as a utility company, landlord, property owner, or moving company, and MDHI does not fund households directly. All requests are made by the organizations that partner with MDHI on behalf of clients. Assistance is tracked to ensure there is no duplication of services. To donate, you can visit mdhi.org/donate. In some cases, we've seen as little as $57 that's keeping a family from a home. This fund helps remove those last few barriers, Reif said. With the holidays quickly approaching, we're asking for the community's support in providing hope in the form of housing this season. And there are a few obituaries in today's Denver Post, so I will read the basics from those. The first one, Marilyn Butterman, 85, Denver, wife of the late Norman Butterman, mother of Susan Brody, Daniel Butterman, Stephen Butterman, and the late Bruce Butterman. Sister of Ronald Silver, grandmother of Jason Brody, Zachary Hunter, Adam, Kevin, Jared Butterman, and the late Jordan Brody. Service Friday, November 5th at 1 p.m. at Mount Nebo Cemetery. Live stream available on Feldman Mortuary's YouTube channel. Contributions to the Anti-Defamation League Mountain States Region. Austin Chitwood, born February 14, 1980, and died October 27, 2021. Austin Vale Chitwood was born in Fort Collins. More info is available at thenaturalfuneral.com. Annette Hayes, born December 24, 1943, and died October 16, 2021. More information is available at beyondthe-dash.com. Mary Ellen Skinner, born November 8th, 1956, and died October 16th, 2021. Mary Ellen Skinner. Oh, we've got a misspelling here. The headline says Skinner, so we'll say Mary Ellen Skinner Dolan of Arvada, Colorado, was born in Denver, Colorado, to Miles and Loretta Dolan. She is survived by her sisters, Patricia Dolan and Diane Kress, daughters Brittany Skinner, Savannah Bermudez, Rachel Skinner, and granddaughter Azalea. Services will be at Family in Christ Community Church on Sheridan Boulevard in Westminster on Friday, November 5th, 2021 at 12 noon. Geraldine Zodro, born October 7th, 1943, and passed away October 27th, 2021 in Denver. She was born to Morris and Arline Maggi in San Francisco, California, but spent most of her formative years in Dighton, Kansas. She married John Jack Zodro in 1984, and they remained married until his death in 1995. She leaves behind her brother Gerald Maggi, niece Anna Walker, nephews Josh Maggi, Bobby Maggi, and Matt Maggi, stepchildren Louise Haddad, John Zodro, Drew Zodro, Lyndra Kozler, Ann Zodro, Jean Zodro, and many great nieces and nephews, stepchildren, and step-grandchildren. Celebration of Life to follow in Denver in the coming weeks, and more information will be found at fairmountfuneralhome.com. Donations in her memory can be made at pmgawareness.org or kif1a.org. And returning to local news, Boulder County former deputies sentenced to prison by Mitchell Byers of the Daily Camera. The two former Boulder County Sheriff's deputies convicted of recklessly causing the death of a man they were transporting to detox were sentenced to prison on Thursday. James O'Brien, 52, was sentenced to 6 years in prison, and Adam Lund, 39, was sentenced to 3 years in prison by Boulder District Judge Norma Sierra on Thursday. Both men were found guilty of manslaughter in the death of Demetrius Shankling, 23, after a joint trial in August. Sierra said O'Brien and Lund not only failed Shankling, but the public trust placed in them as law enforcement officers. He deserved to be treated with dignity, Sierra said of Shankling. Instead, what we saw is he was treated with judgment. The sentencing range for the manslaughter charge was 2 to 6 years, and both sentences will be followed by 3 years of parole. The district attorney's office had asked 6 years for O'Brien and 4 years for Lund based on findings and recommendations in their individual pre-sentence report investigations. But for the reckless conduct of James O'Brien and Adam Lund, Demetrius Shankling would be alive today, District Attorney Michael Doherty said in a statement. Instead, because of them, the 23rd birthday he celebrated that night was his last. The jury, along with other members of law enforcement, recognized that the defendant's conduct was reckless, dangerous, and the reason Demetrius died. My staff and I have the privilege of working with outstanding women and men in law enforcement every single day. At the same time, we have the responsibility of seeking justice when a crime is committed and doing the right thing in every case. It is a tragic, sad case. According to an arrest affidavit, O'Brien and Lund were called by Boulder police to pick up Shankling at 2:20 a.m., September 9, 2018. While the two deputies were working an extra shift doing transport duties for the Addiction Recovery Center. According to body camera and transport van surveillance, the two deputies physically placed Shankling on his stomach with his hands behind his back in one of the transport transport van's holding compartments, which contained benches with seat belts. The passenger side rear compartment where Shankling was placed is less than 5 feet long, and Shankling was 6 feet tall, according to the affidavit. For Shankling to fit, the man's legs had to be lifted off the floor. The affidavit said the deputies pressed on the compartment door to get it shut, causing Shankling's left leg to get wedged against the inside of the door. Shankling was in the van for 16 minutes while being transported to the Addiction Recovery Center. When the deputies arrived at the center, they found Shankling unresponsive and not breathing. While Sierra agreed with defense attorneys that neither deputy intended for Shankling to die and that they did everything they could to resuscitate him, their reckless actions resulted in a death. Contrary to their training and their common sense, Mr. O'Brien and Mr. Lunn allowed Mr. Shankling to remain in position where there was pressure on his torso, instead of putting him on his side or upright, Sierra said. Both men resigned from the sheriff's office before the trial. This entire incident is a tragedy to everyone involved, including Mr. Shankling and his family, as well as these former deputies and their families, Sheriff Joe Pell said in a statement. I'm sure of one thing. This death did not need to occur. I'm also sure these former deputies intended no harm. I am confident we took all the necessary steps for accountability and transparency during this process. We relied on the justice system for a just outcome, and we trust that outcome is the best it can be under a horrible and yet preventable situation. I am deeply saddened for everyone involved. Sierra acknowledged the case was a little different because of the low risk factor and lack of criminal history for the defendants, but she said it did not take away from the seriousness of the case. This does not mean they are bad people. It does not take away their many positive contributions, Sierra said. It means that on one evening they acted recklessly, and that one reckless act resulted in someone's death. Turning to some national briefs, possessions of man behind ice bucket challenge up for sale. Dateline, Boston. Jerseys, baseball bats, and other items that belonged to Pete Freights, the former college baseball player whose inspiring fight with Lou Gehrig's disease helped popularize the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge, are being auctioned. Proceeds from the online auction that runs through Tuesday will benefit the Peter Freights Family Foundation, which assists ALS patients and their families with the cost of home health care, according to a spokesperson for auctioneer KBK Sports. The goal is to raise about $10,000. Items for sale include a signed and framed photograph from New England Patriots coach Bill Belichick and a Boston Bruins jersey signed by former player Bobby Orr. Freights, a former Boston College baseball player who lived in Beverly, north of Boston, died in December 2019 after a 7-year battle with ALS. He and his family inspired the spread of the Ice Bucket Challenge and helped raise millions of dollars for research into the motor neuron disease, which has no cure. And that is from the Associated Press, BBB. Joe Exotic says he has aggressive form of cancer, Dateline Oklahoma City. The man known as Tiger King, who gained notoriety in a Netflix documentary after his conviction for trying to hire someone to kill an animal rights activist, says he has cancer. It is with a sad face that I have to tell you that my prostate biopsies came back with an aggressive cancer, Joe Exotic, who is being held at a federal prison in Fort Worth, Texas, wrote on a Twitter post Wednesday. The former Oklahoma zookeeper, whose real name is Joseph Maldonado Passage, was featured in the popular documentary Tiger King, Murder, Mayhem, and Madness. He was sentenced to 22 years in prison in 2020 after being convicted for violating federal wildlife laws and a failed murder-for-hire plot targeting Carol Baskin. A three-judge panel for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit in Denver in July ordered that he be resentenced to a shorter term. Maldonado Passage asked for prayers and the world to be my voice to be released, saying there is no evidence he committed crimes. And that is from the Associated Press. Analyst who contributed to dossier is charged. Dateline Washington. A Russian analyst who contributed to a dossier of Democratic-funded research into ties between Russia and Donald Trump was arrested Thursday on charges of lying to the FBI about his sources of information, among them an associate of Hillary Clinton. The case against Igor Danchenko is part of Special Counsel John Durham's ongoing investigation into the origins of the FBI's probe into whether Trump's 2016 campaign and Russia had conspired to tip the outcome of that year's presidential campaign. The indictment is the third criminal case brought by Durham and the second in a two-month span. It is likely to boost complaints from Trump allies that well-connected Democrats worked behind the scenes to advance suspicions about Trump and Russia that contributed to the FBI's election year investigation. And UK authorizes Merck pill to treat COVID-19 by Matthew Perrone and Maria Chang, Dateline London. Britain granted conditional authorization on Thursday to the first pill shown to successfully treat COVID-19 so far. It is also the first country to okay the treatment from drug maker Merck, although it was not immediately clear how quickly the pill would be available. The pill was licensed for adults 18 and older who have tested positive for COVID-19 and have at least one risk factor for developing severe disease, such as obesity or heart disease. Thank you for joining us for the Friday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Tammy.
Colorado's Safety Net Health Centers are on a fast track to bring more people of color and those living in rural areas into good-paying healthcare jobs. Sarah McCrander with the Colorado Community Health Network says a new grant from SyncUp Colorado will allow health centers to develop staff that are connected to their communities and patients.
Because we know that when people receive care from people that look like them or from the communities that they live in, the care and the health outcomes improve.
The Grow Our Own initiative will give clinics tools to connect with youths from historically underrepresented communities and help them make important first steps toward health careers they may not have seen as possible. Anyone interested in joining the program, which will initially focus on recruiting medical assistants, can find more information at missiondrivencareers.org. Nearly 9 in 10 new jobs in Colorado require a post-secondary degree, but just 58% of residents have a professional certificate or college degree. Two-thirds of graduates also end up with significant student loan debt. McCrander says by teaming up with colleges and universities, students will be able to earn decent wages as they work toward a range of certificates and degrees.
Say you're a radiology tech and you've done a certification through that you'll be able to apply some of those credits that you earn through that certification program to a future bachelor's degree.
Grow Our Own was one of six winning partnerships using modern apprenticeships and hybrid college approaches to increase student access to the state's fastest-growing industries that pay a living wage, including healthcare and construction. This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Audio Information Network of Colorado.
Did you know that some snacking habits can harm your teeth? Snacks and drinks high in sugar can lead to cavities. The sugar in our food becomes acid once it mixes with bacteria found in our mouth. That acid wears away the hard covering of the tooth to create a cavity. Be aware that diet, soda, and drinks don't contain sugar, but the acid in these products erode the enamel, which leads to weakened teeth and cavities. So, what can you do to protect you and your family's teeth? Choose a variety of healthy snack options like whole grain products, milk, cheese, lean meats, fruits, and vegetables. Limit the amount of sugar in your diet and avoid snacking all day. If you have children, talk to them about the effects diet has on the body and their teeth so they can learn to make smart choices for themselves in the future. This message brought to you by DentaQuest Administrator of Health First Colorado, Medicaid, and the CHP Plus Dental Programs. For information about your DentaQuest dental benefits, finding a provider, or help scheduling an appointment, Health First Colorado members call 1-855-225-1729. Again, that phone number is 1-855-225-1729. TTY 711. And CHP Plus members call 1-888-307-6561. Again, that's 1-888-307-6561, TTY 711, or visit us at DentaQuest.com/Colorado.
Do you have low vision? Have you had to stop reading or doing other things you love to do? Insight Skill Center provides low vision rehabilitation services to help you adapt your skills and stay active and independent. We offer low vision assessments, occupational therapy, training, and assistive technology devices. Program fees may be covered by your insurances or through our Boulder County Area Agency on Aging program. Call us today at 970-407-9999 to find out how we can help you.